Jay can't afford.
The Ernest Hemingway of the cinema.
Mr. Hanover.
I just want to know what he represents.
The man is infested with disciples. I'm the apostle.
Just like me and God, how could you tell us apart?
Hanover's new movie?
The Other Side of the Wind.
What's that about the movie?
We don't talk about the movie.
So you old guys are trying to get with it. Is that what this movie's about?
Well, we don't actually know.
What do we know? Jake is just making it up as he goes along.
He's done it before.
Movies and friendship. Those are mysteries.
Mr. Hanover, could you please slow down?
Mr. Hanover!
What he creates, he has to wreck. It's a compulsion.
Want me to bring you another scotch?
We'll have our own movie. A real movie.
The Other Side of the Wind.
Well, here it is. If anybody wants to see it.
Hello, and welcome back to the Film and Water Podcast, proud member of the Fire and Water Podcast Network. I'm your host, Rob Kelly, and on the last episode of the show, which guest star Max Amaro and I did for Halloween, we covered Orson Welles' radio adaptation of War of the Worlds, which was really kind of at the beginning of Welles' career, at least as a national figure. And now we're back to focus on Orson Welles at the end of his career, sort of, as we discuss the man's final film, The Other Side of the Wind, which debuted on Netflix back in November. And there is no one better to join me on this show than the author of the fantastic book, Orson Welles' last movie, The Making of The Other Side of the Wind, than returning guest Josh Karp. Hi, Josh. Welcome back.
Hey, Rob. Thanks for having me.
I'm thrilled to have you here. I mean, we talked about on your previous episode how much I love the book. And when that book came out, I don't think I knew anything about Netflix being in the market to finish this movie. I think that was still kind of, I read your book as a kind of like, well, okay, I hope someday this will be a thing. And then it seemed like not too long after I finally read the book, Netflix was going to finish it. Like, what an amazing turn of events.
Yeah, you know, I mean, well, I think there was this kind of confluence of things that happened. You know, one thing, one of the producers, Philip Jan Rimsa, had made a deal with Orson's former mistress, who held some of the rights to the film. And he got, so there was a, like, I think that was in the fall, or in the winter of 2015. And so in December, 2014. So in December, there's like this big New York Times front page picture of him in the vault, the fabled vault in Paris, looking at this footage. And right around the same time, I had been, my book was going to come out in April, and I was writing, an excerpt of it for Vanity Fair. And there was question as to when it was going to run. And Graydon Carter, who was editing Vanity Fair at the time, apparently saw the thing on the front page of the New York Times, and I think had no idea that I was working with one of his editors. And he was like, "Well, why the hell aren't we covering this?" So it wound up in, I think, their March or April issue. And I did not find this out until long, long after the fact, and I take like zero credit, but it's interesting because the people who at Netflix, who I wound up dealing with on the documentary, you know, had said, at least one of them was like, yeah, you know, we found out because we had seen the article in Vanity Fair.
Wow.
And then got in touch with, you know, the people who were involved. So there, I mean, I'm not sure that's 100% like the entire story, but there is, I was kind of like blown away, and, you know, Vanity Fair has a lot of reach. So I think that was very helpful. But yeah, so that was kind of what happened. So they got involved, and it was still a long road. You know, it's like the deal that couldn't be made kind of thing. And they, I think it took them a good, at least a year, if not two after that, to get the deal done.
Unbelievable. I mean, I've always heard these stories, and then again, it was sort of confirmed in your book about why this film was so impossible to put together. Is because the rights were sort of split up three ways, right? It was basically Welles' daughter his mistress, who you mentioned, Oya Kodar, who was in the movie, and then, right, like, the French government, right? Was that right? Or some government? I mean, we know that there was Iranian money involved, and that then when the Shah got deposed, that became this whole thing in 1980. But it was really that you couldn't get all three parties to agree to a deal unless, of course, you showered them with money necessarily. And nobody wanted to shower them with money because this seemed like a dubious financial prospect of Orson Welles' last movie.
Right. I mean, I think at the time when showering with them with money was a realistic prospect, which was kind of the late 80s and early 90s, the parties could not agree. Nobody could agree that they had enough money.
Okay, right.
So there were a couple of people who did throw a lot of money at them. They said, you know, well, I'll give you this much. And they'd say, or how much do you want? And they'd say, well, we want this much. And they'd say, okay, we'll give it to you. And they'd say, well, we want twice that much.
Oh man.
And it just kept going like that. And it was just, you know, any two parties that agreed, you know, couldn't get the third party to agree. And the third party always changed, you know? So, and there was, you know, there was like bad blood between, you know, Orson's daughter and his mistress, which is not, you know, surprising.
Yeah. Wow. What a shock.
Yeah. And there was, you know, and the French government had impounded the film because, what happened was Orson owned these weird rights. You know, it was kind of a little bit, you know, like the producers. I mean, the Iranians kept restoring his share of the film. They were financing it, the Iranian government. And he kept spending more than the budget. I mean, and he wasn't spending crazy money, but he was spending more than he had in the movie. And they kept, and then he'd say, you know, well, I want my share restored if we're going to keep working on the movie. So they'd give him 50% of the movie back. And that happened a couple times. So by the time everything kind of went to hell in Iran, you know, Orson financially really owned, like, you know, at least in my recollection, almost like none of the movie. But in France, of all places, and this is like so typical of the story of this film, is that, you know, in France, they have this weird law, and I'll mangle the French here, called like droit d'auteur, which is rights of the author, in which he literally has like a moral or artistic right to his work, in which anybody who writes a book or makes a film or whatever retains some interest into what happens to it, regardless of whether they have a financial interest in it. Hmm. So now you have the Iranians and the other parties, and the French government says, hey, you know, nobody can do anything without the other one's consent. And until then, we're locking it up in this film lab. And it sat there for like, you know, well, we're talking 30, you know, 30 plus years. So it was as messy as it could possibly get.
Now, as a total granular level obsession with this, like you talk about that the film being, you know, locked up in a vault somewhere, like someone has to pay for that. Like, who is paying for that? Because film deteriorates, obviously, if you don't take care of it. I mean, who was footing the bill for this footage sitting in a locker somewhere for 40 odd years?
That is a great, great question that I can only guess at the answer. I will promise you it was none of the parties involved.
Right. That's the thing. I'm like, I always wondered about that. I'm like, well, somebody pays that bill every month when it comes due to, you know, we're storing the 400 cans of Orson Welles' last film, in, you know, in a locker somewhere. Okay. Yeah. Pay it again. Like, okay. You know?
Right. Yeah. You know, I remember somebody saying, something to the effect of, you know, that you had no idea what you were going to find. Right. When you got that, you know, there's somebody who's like, it might turn out to be cornflakes,
right?
You know, so yeah, I mean, it was being, you know, it was impounded at a film lab. I mean, I can't imagine, you know, even, you know, who administers the impounding of a film in a film lab. I mean, how many times in history do you think that's happened? So God knows who footed the bill. You know, for, you know, it may have been, you know, there's the Cinémathèque Française or whatever, which was, I think, somehow involved, or maybe it was, you know, something that was going to be paid upon, you know, maybe the government was footing the bill until somebody finally decided to pay for the film. I have no idea, though they waited a long time.
I mean, it's kind of this thing where the movie is, I feel like it was cursed in a lot of ways, but then also it had some angel looking over it, because I mean, I've heard about all sorts of movies or footage of movies that are much more famous than Other Side of the Wind, and the studios have let that original negative deteriorate because they didn't bother, you know. And yet this movie, and I promise everybody, we are going to talk about the movie at some point. The movie itself looks fantastic. I mean, yeah. when I sat down to watch it on Netflix, I wished I had a chance to see it in the theater, because Netflix did screen it in a couple of theaters on day and date, but it just wasn't anywhere around here. I would have loved to have seen it, but boy, this thing looks like it was made yesterday, and I am just so amazed that it just holds, like, for a film that was so put together on with bits and pieces, literally bits and pieces, when you could do it in people's backyards, do it in people's garages, do it, and yet it looks as beautiful as any blockbuster you would see in the big screen nowadays. When did you saw it on a film festival, right?
Yeah, you know, I mean, I kind of lucked out with the documentary and getting to go to the Venice Film Festival.
Right,
and
Venice, that's right.
Yeah, and it was an interesting experience, because I really had not seen the completed film yet. And so it was interesting, because in Venice I saw the film, and then I saw the documentary the next day, and did a Q&A after that. And, and it was interesting, because in Venice, you know, it was kind of like this stunned response, I would say, by the audience, you know, and I think it was hard to know what to make of it. And then I saw it, and I was like, wow, you know, it was just kind of like, you know, you hear people say stuff like I did a story about Dennis Hopper's film, The Last Movie, and I remember he kept telling people in interviews, he'd say, well, you know, it's really the kind of movie you need to see three or four times to really appreciate it. And you think, like, well, that's like about the craziest possible thing you could say, right, to an audience. And yet it was interesting, because the first time I watched it, and I just kind of was like, huh, I was like, wow, that's it. Okay, there it is. And I didn't know what to make of it. And then in New York, like 2 weeks later, I saw it. And I was curious as to what kind of reaction I was going to get from people, you know, just in general, because I hadn't seen it before Venice. And then in New York, they showed the documentary and then they showed the film. So it was the opposite order. And I don't think that necessarily had anything to do with it, but it was like really interesting, because you could just feel it, this like tidal wave in the audience of people just going like, oh my God, like, you know, like this huge appreciation for what it was, you know, I mean, just everything about it, the cinematography, the performances, all the different things in the film. And it's so funny, because, you know, like that whole Dennis Hopper thing where he's like, well, you know, you can't get everything the first time. And I've always just been like, that's just insane. Like who could ask that of an audience? And yet it's really interesting, because I've seen it several times now, and having written a friggin' book about it and made a documentary about it, I'm like, oh wow, that's something I didn't really think about before. And it was interesting. In New York, my brother-in-law came, and he's, you know, like really super smart, super well educated, and like a real classical sense, not like a, you know, a pop culture education like I've had. And he saw it, and it was so interesting, because he was like, a week later, he's like, you know, he's like, I've thought about it every single day since. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And it's that kind of movie. It really, you know, there's just, he was fascinated. And I think it really is, it's a fascinating movie that you can watch it. And that's a real Wells thing, I think, you know, is you can watch his films over and over and over again. And unlike other people's films, you're like, you know, you really get different things all the time and different pieces of, you know, meaning, I guess, out of it.
Yeah, no, that's absolutely the case. And when I've mentioned on other episodes of the show is that I really discovered Orson Welles' filmography when I worked at a video store right after art school. And I, you know, we had everything. And so I was like just going through Orson. I mean, I'd seen Citizen Kane by that point, and I love Citizen Kane. I genuinely love Citizen Kane. Like, it's one of those movies that people say you have to see it because but I genuinely love it. It's one of my all-time favorite films. And I went on to his later filmography, The Magnificent Ambersons and Touch of Evil and The Stranger and Chimes at Midnight, which was not easy to find, and The Trial. And the thing that I kept going back to with his movies is that I would watch them and I would say, I didn't exactly know what that was about or what the point of it was, or I don't know if that – I don't know. I just don't know. But it left me interested. and I would go back to his movies later on. The first time I ever saw Magnificent Ambersons, I was like, eh, all right, that was kind of dull. And then I watch it again a couple years later because I'm expecting Citizen Kane. You know, I'm expecting another Citizen Kane, which, of course, is impossible. And then I go back to Ambersons a couple years later, and I go, oh, my God, this thing is a revelation. It's as good as Citizen Kane, but in a completely different way. And Welles's films have traveled with me as I have aged. And I go back and I watch them again, and I watched The Stranger like last year, and I was like, huh, that's this. I didn't really think about that the first time I saw it. And that was my reaction to watching Other Side of the Wind. I watched it and I went, huh. Like, I just didn't know what I didn't know what I felt about it. And I've watched it again twice more, and I do keep picking up different things. And that's, and I feel like, well, of course that's my reaction, because that's my reaction to all of Welles's films. It's just, I just don't exactly know what I saw, but I know that I was really interested in it, and I want to go back and revisit it. And so that Hopper quote is perfect, because it really is, they are demanding of your audience something very different than the average person who goes to see Avengers Infinity War, you know, which I loved. I loved that movie, but
me too.
You know, but this is a very different kettle of fish. And so, like I said, I feel weird that we're sitting here talking about this movie that I've now watched three times, and I still don't know exactly how I feel about it. I just don't know.
You know, one thing that I think he had that, you know, because I think they're, like, you know, mentioning Infinity Wars, right? I mean, there's this, like, you know, I mean, that's, it. You know, certainly a stark contrast between Welles and Infinity Wars, but there are these two different things he straddles that, you know, like, there are people who make films that you have to see five times to understand them and enjoy them and appreciate them, right? Because you're only there to, like, understand them. And then there are films that are just really entertaining. I think Kane is the ultimate example of that. Welles was really good at doing, I think, both things. You know, he was able to get you to engage with something that you ordinarily might not want to engage with.
Yes.
You know, and nobody goes into a movie going like, oh, God, you know, I can't wait to see this the fourth time, so I really get it. But he would make the kind of movie, you know, most movies that you need to see four times to get it, you have to really be motivated, right?
Yeah. Like, oh, yeah.
You know, like, you've got to be somebody who's really into films and really into that person's films and all that stuff. And I think, you know, with Welles, there was some quote from him. I remember he said something about how, you know, he always felt like his job was, like, you know, to just get people to stay in their seats. You know, and so he did, like, both things. I mean, not that his movies are, like, you know, Infinity Wars entertaining, you know, like, and explosions and, you know, all this action. But he did this incredible thing where he kind of melded, you know, popular narrative storytelling with multi-layered meaning. You know, and the whole thing of, you know, every single frame he shoots is like every corner of every frame is a piece of artwork. Instead of looking at it, you know, on this, you know, just like, hey, we're making a movie, you know, let's, you know, just get our shot and go, you know, everything, you know, you kind of start to notice like the painting around the corners and you go like, wow, like, God, who took the time to do that? But that's what Welles did.
Yeah, I mean, for anyone who hasn't seen the movie yet, and like I said, it's on Netflix, like the brief plot synopsis, and again, this is what it's about in quotes, but it's about a famed and infamous movie director named J.J. Hannaford, played by another famous director, John Huston. He dies in a car accident. He was about to release his latest movie, and a documentary camera crew has been following him around in the days preceding his death. We see the events leading up to that death, the careers Hannaford destroyed, the enemies he made, and his last film, The Other Side of the Wind. And so this movie is called Other Side of the Wind, and inside the movie is a movie called Other Side of the Wind, where the characters watch that movie. And my biggest takeaway from watching it now, I guess, like I've said three times, is I feel like this movie is a movie version of that final shootout in The Lady from Shanghai with all the mirrors. Because this thing is just an assault on the senses of how many perspectives you as a viewer are expect to follow at any given point. Because again, we've got this camera crew that's there to shoot this documentary, and sometimes we see what they're seeing, sometimes we see what the director Hannaford is seeing, sometimes we see somebody, sometimes we are dropped right into the movie itself, as they're watching it. I mean, this. I mean, Michael Bay gets all sorts of, I don't know, credit or demerit, whatever, depending on your point of view, for like his frenetic editing style. But man, this thing, you would. I know this was. I you know, can we say how much of this was actually put together by Wells and how much of this was put together by people later on based on his notes? Because this is even for, you know, Wells certainly. Became legendary thanks to his editing style for Citizen Kane. But this thing is like a next level. And it's amazing to think that he was like, what, 60 years old or 55 years old when he made it?
He was 55 when he started it. And I think, you know, that, you know, and then of course, I think stopped shooting it when he was about like 61 or 62. I had seen, I think, like 40 or 50 minutes of footage edited by Wells, and then a lot of kind of roughly edited stuff, you know, and different takes of different things when I was working on the book. I don't know, you know, exactly how much of it is officially edited by Wells, but I will say that if anybody who worked on that film, you know, I mean, and everybody who worked on it, you know, I mean, you know, this is not a film that was getting people rich, you know, this recreation by Netflix. That said, I think it's been a very successful project for them. But you know, nobody was doing this to make a ton of money, and everybody deserves a huge amount of credit for the time and effort they put into this. But if anybody really, really, really deserves like some kind of big award for it, it's Bob Murawski, who edited, who did the editing, because he really is the one who, I think, had to walk the tightrope of, you know, what, you know, here's what Wells did, here are Wells's notes, and here's what has to happen to make this a comprehensive story, right, you know, comprehensible story without getting, you know, without making his movie rather than Orson's movie. And that's the hard thing, is because, you know, like with some people, you know, if you just had all the footage and you had the story and you had the script and everything, you know, you could say like, okay, well, you know, get a good editor to put it together. But with Wells, that was like, editing was the key phase. Like, he reinvented every film in the editing phase. So it was a monumental task. And Bob did, you know, just such a remarkable job. It's so daunting. I can't even, you know, I mean, that's, you know, I mean, I can't think of an equivalent thing to have to do, you know, but to go edit, you know, finish the editing of an Orson Welles movie that's, you know, not half done.
Right. Yeah. I have to wonder, like, when he's working on it, like, is there stuff that he had to trim out? And, like, I would imagine you would have the instinct to not do that, because that's footage Orson Welles shot. You know, you would just feel like, this is gold in my hand. It all has to go in. But of course, it probably didn't all go in, because as you talked about, he shot this over the course of 5 years with different people. I mean, this film was so long in the production that they lost an entire actor, Rich Little, the comedian Rich Little, who was originally playing one of the characters, and then he couldn't shoot the film anymore, and they had to replace him with Peter Bogdanovich, who, of course, was a friend of Wells. But, I mean, they lost entire cast members over the length of this film.
Oh, people died, yeah.
Oh, God.
No, Stafford Rep, who was Chief O'Hara on Batman.
Chief O'Hara from Batman is in this movie. That was very strange to see Chief O'Hara in an Orson Welles movie.
One of the weirdest, like, I remember when I was first researching the book, and, you know, and like, and there was no real easy guide to who was in it and all that stuff. And I was looking through some, I'd found some financial documents of who Orson owed money to. I was like, Stafford Rep? It's like, are you kidding me?
Yeah, the people that wander in and out of this movie. I mean, here's the cast list I have in front of IMDb. It's just unbelievable. This sort of who's who of friends of Wells. Of course, I mentioned John Huston a world famous film director playing a world famous film director. Oya Kodargan, Orson's mistress, who is, I don't think she wears a stitch of clothing in this entire movie.
Not if it's on, it's not on for long. Yeah,
She has that necklace that gets caught, but that's about it. Peter Bogdanovich, right. Of course, Susan Strasberg, Norman Foster, who directed Wells in Journey into Fear, Robert Random, Lily Palmer, Edmund O'Brien, Mercedes McCambridge, Cameron Mitchell, Paul Stewart, who of course played Citizen Kane's butler in Citizen Kane. He's the one who talks about, oh yeah, Rosebud, that's what he said at the end. Gregory Sierra from Barney Miller is in this movie.
Right, Chano from Barney Miller. I checked out. That was like the funniest. Like that was insane.
Okay.
When I saw him, I was like he's in this? You know?
And he's one of the few remaining living cast members. He's still around, like him and Bogdanovich.
I like couldn't sleep until I found Gregory Sierra for some insane reason. I was just like,
very weird.
I gotta understand why he's in this movie.
Yeah, Jeffrey Land, Henry Jaglom, Paul Mazursky, Dennis Hopper, Curtis Harrington, Claude Chabrol, George Jessel, the all-time comedian George Jessel, the director Peter Jason, and then my favorite Frank Marshall, the producer, of course, and my favorite actor in this movie, just because of the sheer bizarre, is Angelo Rizzito from Freaks is in this movie. what a traveling band of people that Welles had to put together to make this movie. And it, like I said, it really is just an assault on the senses. So I'm trying to like focus this a little. It's just so hard. But like, what did you think of the movie? I mean, when you've seen it a bunch of times, what do you think it's a worthy addition to the Welles canon? Do you think do you look at it as kind of like, well, it's I should stop asking what you think. What do you think?
I think it is absolutely like, you know, a worthy addition to the Welles canon, you know, as you put it. I mean, I think first of all, taking on that task, where people would say, you know, like, are you involved at all with, you know, that part of it. And my only involvement with that was, you know, like I'd help them identify cast members and stuff like that. Right, but I was like, no, thank God I'm not involved. I'm like, that's like the scariest job I can think of, you know? And like, you know, I don't want to be, you know, like, that's just such an overwhelming task. And I really, you know, I really think they did an incredible job. And you know what? I really think, you know, while it is not, you know, I don't profess to know what Welles would have done, but I think they did it where it is an Orson Welles movie. And I think it is, you know, like you said, it's this, you know, the Lady of Shanghai thing is, I think, you know, a really astute observation. I've kind of always thought of it as being like, you know, Citizen Kane is such a, such a clear film. If you know what I mean, like anybody can see it, and that story, which is so complicated, is so universal at the same time, you know, and still is, you know, today, that story is a story that, you know, can resonate with like anyone. And this to me always seemed like Citizen Kane kind of refracted through the broken mirror pieces from Lady of Shanghai.
Yes, that's a perfect way of putting it, yes.
You know, and that he began his career with this perfect piece of art, and he ended it with, and I don't mean this, you know, as a criticism, but with this, I think, purposely imperfect piece of art that runs up against a lot of the same themes as Kane, you know, kind of the great man, you know, except you see, you know, what happens to a great man. And what, you know, what does success mean to somebody? What, you know, what is the corrupting influence of that? What is, you know, all these things that are raised in Citizen Kane are raised again in this film, except they're just twisted through, you know, this broken funhouse mirror. And so, and for that reason, I mean, I think it's an unbelievable movie. And I think the performances he got out of Houston and Bogdanovich are just like astounding. You know, and speaking of, by the way, Rich Little, you know, just total aside, one of the great things they did was, you know, Bogdanovich, who was playing a different character, right, winds up playing Rich Little's character when Rich Little leaves. And Rich Little's character, for just to confuse anyone who's going to be listening to this, is based on Bogdanovich.
Just to throw you off a little bit, Brooks Otterlake, one of the great names in all of cinema, Brooks Otterlake. But yeah, so you've got Rich Little playing Bogdanovich, a Bogdanovich-like character who is then replaced in the film by Bogdanovich.
Right, who was initially playing himself in 1970 as a guy writing a book about Welles. Instead, he's writing
which
a
he
book
was about, really doing.
Which he was really doing. But you know what's really funny is as I'm watching the movie, one of the best things with the editing was I'm like, oh my god, they figured out a way to keep Rich Little in the movie because he shows up.
He does. Oh my god. I went through the party guest list. I mean the cast list. There's also if you go further down the list of people that are in this movie as party guests that appear. Cameron Crowe is in this movie.
Yes.
I mean, you know, I work for CBS. My former boss, Les Moonves, is in this movie as a party guest.
So when I was working on it, one of the people, Showtime at one point had considered finishing the film, like in the late 90s. And I think Joe McBride, who was a great Wells biographer and was a huge help with the book and who appears in the film as a biographer of Hannaford's, told me that a Showtime executive had allegedly gone to Les Moonves, you know, because CBS owned Showtime or whatever it was at the time. And he said, you know, so we're thinking about finishing this Orson Welles movie you've probably never heard of. He said, we need, you know, X million dollars. He said, it's called The Other Side of the Wind. And Les Moonves, you know, like in a, you know, in a comedy act, says, he goes, heard about it. I'm in it. And so, you know, and despite all that's happened to him, you know, since then, I will say it was really funny because I was like, you know, I gotta at least try to talk to him because, you know, what kind of weird perspective must this be? And I was like, but I thought, no way. And I asked CBS, you know, PR, and I was like, hey, you know, I'd like to talk to Les Moonves about this. And they were like, yeah, whatever. Sure, we'll give it a shot for you. And the next day they're like, you know, Mr. Moonves can talk to you tomorrow. And he loved talking about it. It was so funny. And that was the great thing about this movie. And I think the thing about people like Wells and Houston that is completely no longer existent in this world, certainly not in the world of Hollywood, is that making that movie, you know, the moment anybody crossed paths with Orson Welles was a moment they would remember for the rest of their friggin' life.
And that's how he got stuff done, was he, and because he knew that. He knew that people were just so in love with being in the orbit of Orson Welles. I mean, Gary Graver, the cinematographer, he pretty much gave up his entire life to work for Orson Welles.
Gave his whole life to the guy. Right. Yeah. And all these people, everybody. And same with Houston, you know, The moment you met John Huston or Orson Welles for 5 minutes was something you would talk about for the rest of your life. And for them, it was, you know, 8 to 8:05 on one Tuesday night.
Right.
You know, they forgot the minute they left the room. You know, they were just such magnificently gigantic figures.
And Houston had that Houston's voice in this movie. Oh, my. I mean, every movie he was in as an actor is fantastic. He has that voice. I'm doing a horrible. You could just hear. You would literally be a guy that you could listen to read the phone book, and you would be enraptured because of that incredible whiskey-soaked voice he had. And Wells uses it to perfect effect in this film.
Right. Oh, no. He's the best. I mean, like I loved. There's the, you know, the great story of, you know, what Houston had directed, you know, like 50 films or something, and he'd appeared in like 40 films and all this stuff. And Bogdanovich shows up to play himself, replacing Rich Little, and you know, Bogdanovich loved to do impersonations, and you know, and I think had appeared in, you know, one or two films or something, and. So they're sitting there, and Houston, you know, completely has no idea who Bogdanovich is, and he gets introduced to him, and they said, you know, he goes, actually, Orson introduced Rich Little to him as the greatest living American impressionist, and he said, oh, I love art. He said, we're going to have a lot of great conversations, which I always love about Houston. And with Bogdanovich, there's this great story where he said, you know, he said, so Peter, he says, how many movies have you been in? He said, two. He goes, two? Must be very easy to keep track of them. You know, I can't do the voice either, but, you know, just so, you know, perfect in his voice, you know, just complete. And like that. And really, I think, you know, I mean, I could talk about him all day. He's like one of the coolest, most fascinating guys, I think, whoever lived. And there's no modern equivalent to these people.
No, oh no, and the thing that's interesting is that I think I read this in places that, of course, Welles probably would have wanted to have the career as a director that Houston had, because Houston seemed to be able to navigate the studio system a little more effective. I mean, the list of his great films, I mean, good Lord, The Treasure of the Sierra Madre and The Man Who Would Be King and The Maltese Falcon. I mean, these masterpieces. And yet he seemed to kind of all, you know, he cranked out his sort of genre stuff where he becomes like a, you know, a director for hire with like Annie or like The Macintosh Man or whatever. But
right.
he seemed to be able to navigate that world that Welles couldn't. Welles just got chewed up and spit out. And I always think that Welles probably admired Houston for that a little, that Houston just could had that facility that Welles just did not. And the even though Jake Hannaford, the character, is certainly not someone of, I don't know, you're not terribly sympathetic to him because he seems like a really kind of bastard. At the same time, I feel like the love that Welles has for his pal John Huston, and there's all those great pictures of them drinking together where they're laughing uncontrollably. I don't know. I feel like it gives Huston an amazing character to play, and I feel like that's Welles' almost tribute to his friend to give him such a – and he gets the final line of the film, which is unbelievable, a great way to end Orson Welles' film with that final line and that final shot. But I don't know. I feel like I can feel Orson's love for John Huston watching this film, even though Hannaford is not a character you really want to be around a whole lot.
No, but, you know, what's interesting is he makes – you know, you have to be John Huston to pull off that character.
Yes.
Do you know what I mean? Because he has so much innate charm that he can take this, you know, despicable, you know, I mean, not despicable is the wrong word, but, you know, certainly not the most always likable or admirable character and make him, you know, somebody who you know, can really follow. And you know, the thing I always to me, you know, watching the film and seeing that, and I knew this from having watched even the, you know, the short version I had seen working on the book, is he got John Huston, who is, to my mind, the most invulnerable human being who ever lived. I mean, he is like full on John Huston all the time. You know, like, you know, just the kind of guy who, like, nothing could kill him, nothing could get under his skin, which is what made him able to make so many movies, you know, as opposed to Welles. I mean, I think he didn't have that sensitivity. And I don't mean that in a bad way, but, you know, I mean, he didn't have, you know, John Huston's feelings didn't get hurt. You know, John Huston
right.
was just through it, and he just moved on, and he always had this kind of, you know, utter invulnerability and confidence that I think Welles, you know, Welles kind of cared too much, and Huston cared enough, but not so much that he was crippled by anything. And one of the things that I thought was so remarkable about Welles is he gets Huston to be like vulnerable in a couple of just like little moments. And, you know, and you're just like, oh my God, like, you know, I mean, and I don't think, and he wasn't like, you know, John, okay, now let's do your vulnerable scene.
Right. You know? Right.
And, you know, he really had to, like, he had to coax that out of him. And at the same time also coax it out of Bogdanovich, who's a very well-defined kind of, you know, Hollywood character of the time, you know, who also is like, you know, he is what he is, you know, and he's not, you know, a guy who you're like, you know, oh, he's sweet and vulnerable and wonderful, you know, all the time. You know, his character is not that.
Not right. Yeah, he has the moments where he's very sardonic and stuff like. There's the line about, you know, somebody's making a film about Jake Hannaford, and you know what? There are other people who aren't. You know, he had that line about that where he's so he's I love all his impressions, by the way, too. Yeah, he's very, very funny.
Oh.
But he's has that. I agree with the thing about Huston. Huston did seem sort of bulletproof in a lot of ways. He just was able to get through all this. But I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt you.
Oh, no, you didn't know. I was just going to say, like, you know, I mean, you know, Huston is this, you know, like, bulletproof, like you said, and you know, Bogdanovich has kind of this, like, you know, kind of slick Hollywoodness about him. And yet, both of them, there are just moments, like, just these little moments where you're like, oh, my God, like, these guys, you know, they're just like, you see them just, like, putting their soul out there in a way that, like, you just never would have imagined. How he managed to do that, I have no idea. You know, I mean, I think that is a testament to his greatness in working with actors, because that's not something with those kind of people where you tell them, okay, John, now get emotional, you know.
Right, right.
John Huston was all about not being emotional. You know, so, and same with Bogdanovich. So, I mean, I think that was, he makes their relationship so kind of touching in this weird way for two characters that are not the most lovable characters.
The look on Hannaford's face when it is near the end of the film, where it is it is surmised that he maybe has a more than healthy interest in his leading man, yes. And almost in a sexual way. The look on Houston's face of just utter shock and sort of, it's a combo of like shock and shame at maybe being discovered, and then it turns into anger. It's terrifying. Like the thought, yeah, of John Huston being mad at me would scare me. That would be so, my right. God.
You know, yeah, this is a totally random aside, but this is kind of funny. His son, and this is a difference, I think, between great difference between Wells and Houston, is his son Danny was explaining that we're talking about con men, and he said how much his father loved con men,
okay,
and how he even liked con men who had conned him, and that like one of his best friends conned him into buying a whole bunch of artwork that was like completely, you know, not what he said it was. And he was just like, you're like, oh, Billy, you know, like, like, I just love that. Like, it was funny. I thought that was like one of the most telling stories ever about somebody, is that like, not only did he love con men, he didn't even mind being conned because he just thought it was such a great, you know, kind of interesting experience.
That is fantastic. I mean, one other thing I wanted to ask you about, well, not, I want to ask you a bunch of things, but one thing specifically is, I feel like, how do you feel this movie works for, and so I get, maybe it's hard for you to say necessarily because you have this knowledge, but like, as I watched this movie, I was informed by all the stuff that I knew in the background. And I wonder, does this movie work the same as well if you don't know all that stuff? Like, so like for instance, like, you know, the movie they're watching within the movie, Other Side of the Wind, which is clearly a parody of kind of like the mod late 60s Antonioni stuff. And they were making fun of that. And yet at the same time, as I'm watching it, and it's basically all these scenes of just two actors, Robert Random and playing John Dale, and Oya Kodar as the actress, who I mentioned is naked throughout the entire movie. It's right. Just them running around these weird, desolate landscapes with deep shadows. And it's very pretentious. But yet I also found it highly entertaining. Like, I was sort of like in my own mind going, I'd like to see a whole movie of Orson Welles just doing his fake Antonioni, because this is really entertaining. The scene in the bathroom with the girl putting the ice cube in her mouth, I was like, what? This is utterly compelling, even if it's baffling.
I think they, you know, that was what I remember interviewing one of the editors who, you know, there were 80 million editors who worked with them over the years on this, because like, you know, everybody, you know, being an editor, you were just his assistant. You were just doing what he said. He was the editor. And I remember he said, he goes, I spent an entire summer editing the bathroom orgy scene. And it was funny because, you know, like, first of all, he said, you know, he's like, you know, I can't remember what he described as how many cuts. I mean, the scene is, you know, like 2 minutes long. You know, he said, you know, a typical scene that long would have X number of cuts. Yeah, this had, you know, 50, 80 times as many cuts. And it was shot over the course of like 3 or 4 years. And so Oya actually ages, right? Like, you had to deal with the fact that she was aging, you know, like she was, you know, going from being like 30 to 35, which is a day transition or, you know, in life. And, you know, and like, and just all this crazy stuff. And that scene is just creepy as friggin' hell, like with that kid with the ice cube and all that weird stuff.
Oh man.
And that whole scene where she take, you know, not that this is going to ruin the movie for anybody because it's so confusing anyway, but like, you know, where she like pokes the eyes out of the doll, you know, with the, or whatever she does in the, you know, in the nightclub. And it's just so weird. And yeah, and it's like, it's bizarre and you can't believe it's an Orson Welles movie. Yet if you break it down, again, going back to like the mirror scene, you know, Lady from Shanghai, it's very much like that. It's very much Welles, you know, type stuff. But the big, you know, exterior, you know, shots, you know, of them you know, in this weird, you know, lunar, you know, ultra modern landscape. That is like, that is really Wells, you know, doing Antonioni or doing, you know, kind of some kind of new wave, you know, symbolic filmmaking, which of course he thought was a bunch of crap. So he loved doing it up in the biggest way he possibly could.
I mean, but I mean, it's also really compelling. I mean, the scene in the car, this long wordless scene of the driver, and then you get Oya Kodar, and then Bob Random, who, and she starts having sex with him in the car silently, and it's only the only sound in the whole scene is just the sound of the windshield wipers going back with the rhythmic dun 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 dun. And I'm watching it, and I'm going, all right, I know that I'm watching a parody, but I'm also enjoying this just by itself. Like, I was sort of shocked of how much eroticism there was in this. You don't think of Orson Welles or anybody from that era kind of doing erotic stuff, because obviously they weren't, that wasn't open to them. But I mean, it's kind of amazing how much sort of sex and nudity is in this movie when it's, you think of that it's an Orson Welles movie, but like that scene in the driver's seat, I was like, okay, this is workable as an erotic, it's a parody, but it also works just as an erotic scene in a movie.
Yeah, what's really funny too is, I mean, not only was it not indicative of somebody of Welles' generation, it was, I mean, Welles was really like, there's like no suggestion of sex in anything he does before this. You know, I mean, there's like none. I mean, he is like one of the most prudish, you know, filmmakers in a way. And so that's really not, you know, something, you know, and in fact, the big relationships in his films are almost always, with the exception of, you know, Lady from Shanghai, are almost exclusively, you know, male-male relationships, not homosexual necessarily, but they're about relationships between men.
Right.
And there's really, I mean, no hint of, you know, there's very little hint of romance or anything sexual or erotic. And there's some great quote from him where he said, you know, the two things that don't work on screen are sex and religion. And he's like, you can't put two people in bed or put somebody on their knees with their hands folded. He's like, in a film, and make me believe it.
Wow.
And so, you know, but I think he, you know, what's funny is like, again, this is like, you know, all of his work in this weird way, you know, he did this, he was such a fascinating, multi, you know, faceted guy who was of such great depth in so many different ways. And, you know, all of his films are completely individual works of art, and about what they're about. And they're also all kind of, in my mind, about him. And, you know, there's some element of it that's like this kind of like hidden autobiography. And if he was alive, he would like, you know, put out a cigar in my face for saying any of this, because he hated all that kind of talk. But, you know, I watched his movies and I was like, well, you know, he's such a big character. And like, when it really comes down to it, these movies are just all really kind of about some aspect of Welles. And, you know, and I think with Other Side of the Wind, you know, you just get this sense of he makes these two movies, right? You've got this kind of weird, you know, Antonioni-esque movie, and you've got this, what's it called? And then you've got this kind of cinema verite, you know, documentary style film. And he's making, and then you've got Houston playing a character who is at least, you know, even though Welles claimed not, you know, somewhat based on Welles. And so he's making two movies, neither of them in his own style. Right. And he's got a guy who is like him, yet completely unlike him, playing a character inspired by an incident in his own life, and whose experience, at least in terms of, you know, Hollywood, is mirroring, you know, the experience Welles was having at the very moment. And Welles is changing everything in real time to reflect events in his life, you know. And so there's just this, what fascinated me about the story from the very beginning was this whole idea of, you know, I mean, you know, like the whole thing of, you know, Peter Bogdanovich in 1970 is playing Peter Bogdanovich in 1970. And in 1974, he replaces Rich Little playing Peter Bogdanovich in 1974.
Right. And then he's a very different Peter Bogdanovich at that point, because at that point he's released The Last Picture Show and What's Up, Doc? Now, all of a sudden, he's the new guy in 1974.
Right. And then they in the movie, you know, Houston and Bogdanovich have this falling out that is totally like reflective. Later, he has a falling out with Wells, has a falling out with Bogdanovich in real life that mirrors the falling out Bogdanovich has with Houston in the movie.
My God, I'm getting a headache just thinking about it. Like, I do the film a disservice if, as we're talking about this, I make it sound like this is homework, because it's not. It's highly entertaining. I mean, it moves at such a pace, but it is just you are overwhelmed of how much information you're having to process through this movie. So anybody who's listening to this who hasn't seen the movie, I hope I don't make it sound like this is not entertaining. It's a very entertaining movie, but it's a movie with so many levels that you almost just get lost in it, because you're just like, okay, I could take some corner of it and start analyzing that corner, but then there's 47,000 other corners. And this thing is, you know, the line about Johnny Cash said about Bob Dylan, there's so many sizes round. That's kind of how it feels. It's like this thing has just so much to it. Because, I mean, again, you've got John Huston, whose career started off strong and stayed strong basically to the day he died, playing a has-been director who is, okay, kind of Wells-ish, because Wells was considered a has-been at that point. But he's also playing a director who's trying to get back into good graces by doing this faux modernist movie with all nudity and stuff, which something Wells would never do. But yet that is kind of what he's doing here.
It's exactly what he's doing. Right. It's the weird – I mean, that to me was like – and on top of all this, what I – I don't know if I realized this before I started working on the book or while I was working on the book. But, you know, it was all kind of, you know, scripted yet improvised based on the script, right? And Wells shot 90% of this in homes he was renting to live in. Okay, where he was also editing as he went along. So, like, he literally is performing every single phase of the filmmaking process simultaneously in the place where he is living and shooting. And to me, I was just like, this is a guy whose life and his art have just converged upon each other.
Yes.
And the storyline of the film, like I just, you know, said before, is, you know, mirrors so much of what's going on in his life. And it's just like this guy, you know, there's one of the script supervisors those are always, when you're doing a project like this, you always want to talk to somebody like that, like the script supervisor. Like, they're, you know, it's funny, the people who are the best interviews aren't always, you know, like the big famous people. It's like somebody who's a script supervisor is like, let me tell you how crazy it was.
Oh, right, because they're there every day.
Right, and or even there for 2 weeks, because he kept firing them, and they just saw how crazy it was for 2 weeks. And I remember she said, like, she goes, you know, you just really got to a point where you just didn't know what was the movie and what was real life. You know, what was happening on screen and what was happening, you know, behind the scenes, you know, in the house. She's like, it was just all the same at a certain point. She's like, and it was like really disorienting to be there. And on top of it, the guy, you know, Hannaford, or, you know, Houston's character Hannaford, is running out of money and needs money.
Oh, right, yeah.
And Wells is perennially running out of money and needing more money to finish the film.
Yeah.
It's so surreal.
Yeah, I mean, and it really does – I mean, first of all, the first line in this movie, which is this narration from Bogdanovich, it talks about cell phones, which I – like, when I first heard that, like, jumped out at me, because I'm like, well, all right, obviously that's an addition. Like, that's obviously not in the original script, because they're talking about cell phones. But, right. Like, the whole idea – this movie is really ahead of its time in the idea of everyone being constantly recorded.
Right.
I mean, that we are there now, where everybody has in the film, everybody's got a film camera, whether it's a big film camera or a tiny handheld thing. And sometimes you can literally hear the film processing through somebody. But I mean, that's what we're living in now, where everything is recorded all the time. And here, and it on paper, it sounds great that you're like, wow, you're this renowned director that everybody reveres, that the younger generation thinks you're a god. But then you see the reality of it, and Hannaford is constantly being chased by all of these people sticking their microphone in his face and saying, you know, does reality reflect film? Does film reflect reality? And you're like, that would have to be exhausting after a while. Have all these, like, leave me alone, you know?
Just right.
You know? And that's why eventually you think Hannaford just starts giving these bullshit answers because it's all a joke at this point. There's literally a scene where there's somebody trying to record him and they hang off the side of the car.
Right.
Like they're which made me scared because I'm like, that guy could have actually just been killed because this was before they worried about that. So, you know, when you're doing guerrilla filmmaking like that, you're not worried about safety. There's no safety organization making sure somebody's going to be fine.
Yeah, no, but Orson was not. He was not worried about, yeah.
Yeah. But, I mean, it's like – and then as I'm watching it, like you've got this guy, Billy Boyle, who is playing Hannaford's kind of right-hand man. He's a little bit obsequious. He sort of thinks everything Hannaford does is great. Now, he's played by Norman Foster, the director, who directed Welles in Journey into Fear. And I've always heard that Welles directed most of Journey into Fear, that Norman Foster didn't really do it. But you've got that angle. Like, well, I got a guy who's playing the obsequious – you know, toady to this film director played by a guy who could in some regards be considered that to be the guy that was like that to Welles, you know, right. I mean, and then again, you got Paul Stewart in this movie playing a kind of a similar part to what he played in Citizen Kane. He's always sort of sardonically commenting on what's going on the side. You've got the scene later on where Oya Kodar is in bed with Bob Random and they're out on it's this bed out in the middle of nowhere. And you've got John Huston's character, Hannaford, mocking Bob Random for not being able to get it up. And you know, talking about, you can get it up, boy, come on. And I'm like, so you've got Welles directing a guy who is directing another guy who can't get it up in bed with a woman who is Welles' wife.
Right.
Okay, got it.
Right, completely. I mean, it's so, and you know, and for like, and as you said, for anybody, you know, for people listening, it's not as confusing as we're making it sound.
No,
yet
it's
every bit as complex.
You get caught up in it. You just it's like I guess what it would be like being at a party where you eventually are just like, okay, I'm here. I'm just going to watch what's happening and I'm not going to worry about how disorienting this is.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I mean, and that's like, I think that's kind of the, I think, like I said, you know, that's the greatness of Welles is that he's able to make a story you can follow and then also just like layer all this stuff into it, you know, where you're just like, wow. You know, and he really, I mean, so many of the characters, you know, are either people who are his own friend. You know, so many of the people in the movie are like old friends as they were happening in his life. Like Susan Strasberg is added shortly after Pauline Kael writes this big essay in the New Yorker, you know, suggesting that he really took too much credit for the case of Citizen Kane. And then he adds, you know, this character of a film critic, you know, who's kind of up Hannaford's ass about things. And, you know, trying to expose his big, you know, his big secret. And it's just unreal, you know. And he also, you know, he gives Huston some of the greatest lines. I mean, you know, there's that great line with Susan Strasberg where she's poking and prodding him and Bogdanovich. And she says something like, you know, oh, I know why you two are so close, because you have to be. And he just looks at her and he goes, you know, please, dear lady, don't tell us what you mean by that. You know, just every great sardonic, you know, like line, you know, he just gets, you know, Huston is so beautiful, delivers him so beautifully in that voice, you know, you were discussing.
Yeah, it really is a remarkable achievement. And now that you've been talking, I do think that, yeah, that Bob Murawski really deserves the credit for just taking on this task. And I'm so thankful that Netflix did this. Cause like I said, I'm so happy this movie existed. I grew up reading about this movie and figured I would never see it. And the fact that it's here and we can enjoy it. And it really is. It is kind of amazing to think that Welles thought that this would be his big Hollywood comeback, because I can't imagine in 1978 when he made that appeal on the AFI for finishing funds that anybody really thought that this was a commercial project. I mean,
well, and he also made the appeal and then showed a scene that was about, you know, basically about a film that was there was, you know, the Billy Boyle character showing a studio executive this film that was everything everybody feared Other Side of the Wind was.
Right.
You know, and like in all this stuff of, you know, there's the, you know, the executive says, so, you know, so he's just making it up as he goes along, you know, and that's what everybody in the audience is undoubtedly thinking. And Wells, you know, makes this joke, you know, in this moment where he says, you know, and he's looking for end money. You know, not that he figures any, you know, and you're just like, oh my God, dude, like what, like you're being real self-destructive here. I mean, Go ahead. Sorry.
No, it's like I said, it is just that segment of Wells asking for finishing money is unreal. They were doing all those AFI tributes. And of course, most everybody that got one around that time, they did one for like James Cagney and like Betty Davis, I think. You know, they just came out and said nice things. Thank you so much. Oh, thank you, Jack Warner. Thank you, whatever. But here's Wells kind of almost like saying, hey, anybody got some money for me? Like, just can't believe you're seeing it.
Right. And, you know, and it's interesting, too, because I think, you know, on some level he, you know, the first part of the speech is so filled with like humility and charm. And you think, you know, like even though I knew he's not going to get the money. Right. You know, I remember the first time I watched it. I'm like, oh, my God, I'm like, he's doing such a great job. Like, he's going to get the money. You know, he's just like, and now,
yeah. You know,
let me, you know. Like, you know, like, you know, it's like, this is a comparison not many people make, but it's like Ricky Bobby's dad in, you know, in Talladega Nights, you know, whenever everything's about to be nice, he has to screw it all up. You know, it's like Ricky Bobby's dad. He's just like, and now I'm going to get us thrown out of the Applebee's, you know, because like, this is, you know, like, I can't let myself have this thing that I want. You know, and somebody said, God, I can't remember where I read it, but somebody said, you know, he was somebody who, you know, was always like in search of a Judas, you know, and that he needed that, you know, he needed somebody to be his Judas, and Hollywood was like his Judas at that time. Like, and that to, you know, he needed to do all these things to make, I can't imagine how the kind of mind he had, because he had to do all these things to make his life more difficult in order to be stimulated.
Mm.
You know, like people said, you know, he would create problems on the set, you know, like create creative problems so that he could create his way out of them as a way to inspire himself. You know, and he wasn't like, I'm about to start inspiring myself. You know, he was a chaotic person and he created all this chaos. And I remember, I think Frank Marshall said something about, you know, like, you know, and then we had to shut down the set. He said, "Yeah, and that time it wasn't even Orson's fault, you know, you know, like he had to have all this stuff going on, you know, and I think almost like, you know, feel alive creatively, and it must be an enormous burden, I would imagine, to be somebody that talented. I mean, a big realization I had working on the book was, you know, I remember being like, God, he's like the smartest guy I'll ever write about, far and away. Like, never will write about anybody smarter or more talented in my life. And I'm like, and he keeps making throughout his frigging career the same mistake
mm-hmm.
over and over and over again. And how does he not see it? You know, he always goes into business with criminals and people are going bankrupt, and, you know, and he almost knows it. And I was like, you know, and in fact, when somebody steals money from him during this film, one of his producers, you know, he just screams, again!
Yeah.
and I was like, you know, God, he's so smart. How can he not see this? How can he not stop himself from doing this? And then I was, you know, all of a sudden I was like, you know, nobody's like that. Everybody's got like you. Everybody knows, certainly at a certain point in your life, all the things that are screwed up about themselves, and that doesn't mean that you can stop yourself, doing that. And he was, it made him, you know, a lot more human. And you know, I mean, like literally just the worst businessman ever. And I thought to myself, I was like, well, you know, if he was a good businessman or had any ability to navigate Hollywood, it would have been like, you know, it would have been like if Michael Jordan was built like LeBron. You couldn't have somebody who was disciplined and knew how to produce films, you know, from a financial standpoint. And you know what I mean? Like, people just, that doesn't exist. The reason, the greatness, it has to be balanced by the immense flaws. You know, you don't just get guys with little flaws.
Right, right. Yeah, you're playing at that level, and then the problems are just as magnified as the genius is magnified. And that was, yeah, I mean, as all the books I read on Welles, I would see that he would sort of abandon projects right at the moment where he shouldn't have, you know, and he kind of kept doing it. And you're like, stop, you know, just stay focused on this one thing and you'll be okay. And then he wouldn't do it. But, you know, the love of the talent is so great that, like I said, people still fought for this movie. Frank Marshall, I mean, he's kept going on, you know, fighting Bogdanovich, kept fighting for this movie, and now it's here. You know, it's a completed thing, and there are other uncompleted Welles films out there. I mean, there's like the Don Quixote, I believe, that has never quite been finished, or there's that version of Dead Calm. But if those, and I would love to see all those, but if they never get completed, and this is truly his final film, I would be very satisfied thinking this is it, because I don't know if I want to say the final line. In fact, I won't, because in case anybody who's listening to this hasn't seen the movie, I want it to just be nice. But the final shot, the final line of this film is sort of perfect as a capstone to Orson Welles' career as director.
For sure. For sure. Absolutely. And I think in a way, you know, like, you know, like I said before, but I mean, I think it's really true. I mean, you know, it's this beautifully made film that's got this kind of messiness to it, you know, and this, you know, kind of like broken quality to it. And, you know, when you watch Citizen Kane, you're just like, wow, you know, like you watch it and you're like, it's just perfect.
Yes.
You know, even if you don't like it, it's just perfect. And not in an off-putting way. It's, you know, you're just like, that is just like, that is a movie. That is how a movie should be made. And this is kind of like, you know, this end piece to that. And it's like, this is what happens at the end. And it's really somebody, you know, their art. Yeah. And it's funny, you know, I mean, all that stuff. And I think this is something I didn't really appreciate. I appreciate it more and more, especially since the movie has come out, is the idea of the burden of Citizen Kane.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and we all think, you know, like, who could be burdened by making the greatest movie ever when you're 24 years old? And like, yeah, you go through the rest of your friggin' life and everybody's like, you know, what are you, you know, the next thing has to be better than the best thing ever.
Right, right, yeah.
And so he really, I think, his whole life... And it wasn't just because it was Kane, but, you know, he was somebody, everything he did until he was 25 years old was like revolutionary and incredible and, you know, changed genres and changed mediums. And, you know, I think the movie is a lot about what happens at the end of that process. And at the end of having had all of that hanging over you. It shows the confusion of it, I think, you know, it's not necessarily completely an autobiographical film. I think it is very reflective of the inside of Orson's head, which is what a real movie is, right? I mean, it's, you know, mm-hmm. It's a reflection of the mind of the director. And that really, I think is there's this chaos, that is, you know, kind of an amazing reflection of this great artist, you know, towards the end of his career.
Yeah, it's truly an amazing thing. And what a treat that we all have to be able to be inside Orson's head 35 years after he's gone. Like, it just never would have thought that was ever going to happen. So, yeah, it's truly an amazing document. And so anybody listening to this who hasn't seen it, even if you're not familiar with Welles outside of Citizen Kane or some other films, you know, just go and experience it, because it's truly a one-of-a-kind kind of thing. It's a thanks to Netflix for doing it, because now it exists for everybody. You could just click it and watch it right there. Now, before we sign off, there is something we also do need to talk about, the accompanying documentary, because there is this, for everybody who, again, who hasn't seen Other Side of the Wind, there is a Netflix released this documentary on the same day called They'll Love Me When I'm Dead. And it is an amazing documentary. I love it. And Josh, well, like, tell everybody, like, what was your hand in getting this made?
Well, so Morgan Neville, who made Won't You Be My Neighbor, the Mr. Rogers documentary that I think is probably likely to, you know, it's winning a lot of awards and, you know, it's likely possibly going to win, you know, best documentary. And Morgan had won best documentary, I think, in 2014 for 20 Feet from Stardom. And you know, it's funny. He contacted me after reading the Vanity Fair article. And it was, you know, it's kind of funny because, like, you know, not like my life is being, you know, endlessly swamped with phone calls from, you know, filmmakers, but I've had, you know, I've had, you know, two books made into films and they've been optioned by various people over the course of time, you know, and you kind of learn, you know, the first time it happens, you're like, oh my God, somebody wants to make a movie. And then, you know, you like start looking up who they are and you're like, nobody's ever heard of this person. What are they, you know, who are they? And so I got this email and I was like, you know, I was like, you know, who's Morgan Neville? A great documentary. Okay, sure, whatever. You know? And then I Google him and I'm like, holy crap, this guy won an Oscar for best documentary. Okay. So, and Morgan and I, he came to town. I live in Chicago and he was here working on a Netflix documentary about Keith Richards, actually. And we just got together and we were, and we talked and, you know, and he and I, you know, this is maybe more than you need to know, but I mean, like, he and I have an enormous amount in common and, you know, we're like, I'm literally like born almost exactly a year apart and just have like very similar sensibility about things. And he's just a really great down to earth guy. And we were like, okay, you know, like, let's, you know, should we do this as, you know, he was like, you know, I don't know if this should be a feature. I don't know if this should be a documentary, what it should be. And then he has kind of an ongoing deal with Netflix. And when they started to get involved in the negotiations, he was like, you know, we should do a documentary if we can get, if Netflix can get the film and get the footage. He's like, cause I don't want to do a documentary without the footage. So, yeah, so the source material, and this is not to say that it's really based on the book, but I mean, the source material for the documentary is my book. And then I worked with Morgan on it. I did, you know, a lot of, you know, not all of them, and he did, you know, more than I did, but, you know, like, I did a lot of the interviews. And then I, you know, at various points, you know, kind of just, you know, gave my opinion on, you know, various, you know, or, you know, creative things. I mean, he's an amazing, I can't even tell you how lucky I am to have had the opportunity to work with him and had the opportunity to see something, you know, that I had done, taken and kind of interpreted by somebody as talented as he is, I guess, for lack of a better way of putting it. You know, I mean, he involved me and other people, you know, in the creative process quite a bit, but it was, you know, but it's his film. And it was amazing to work with him and see what he made out of it. So yeah, I mean, so I got to be a producer, and I'm a producer, whatever that means. Yeah, right. It was just an incredible opportunity to work with somebody that talented, and I just loved what he did with it. You know, and he brought, you know, I think that's, again, the cool thing with Wells. I mean, he brought new levels of meaning to a story I had fleshed out in the book. And put, you know, his, you know, level of, you know, it's, you know, like there's this great thing where Wells, and I'm not speaking of myself in this capacity, but, you know, Wells, there was like a scene where he got in an argument with a guy who was making one of the Palmas on Wine commercials. Yeah. And he's like, this is your art. He's like, and I'm doing my art. Let's take your art and my art and put them together. Right. And in a way, it's kind of interesting. I don't know that my book is a work of art, but to make something and then have somebody that talented make something kind of using it, mm-hmm. if that makes any sense, and being able to be part of that process is just really cool. And I thought he did an amazing job with you know, so I was really proud of how it turned out, and he was great to work with, and everybody who was involved with it was great to work with. I loved, you know, it's funny, I got to sit in with the editors a couple times and just go through things, and I'd be like, you know, there's a really great quote from one interview I did, and, you know, I've not really been involved in editing a film at all, and they'd be like, oh, and they, I don't know what they would do, but they'd go into their computer, you know, in their terminal, and they would just, like, they'd find the quote in like 4 seconds and pop it into the film, like before, you know, you'd taking a sip of coffee, and they'd be like, does that work better? And I was just, and that was like one of the coolest things to me. Watching the editors work was, and working with them was really, you know, just an amazing experience.
The ultimate tribute I can give that documentary is, and I feel this way about any movie, is that after I watch, it's about 90 minutes. After it was over, I was like, I could have watched 3 hours of this. You know, I was right. So in love with it, and it was so breezy and entertaining, and it showed me all this footage of wells I'd never seen before. And I just was like, I wish this was twice as long. You know, I could live in this and just watch. I mean, watching Orson toy with these reporters is just fascinating. And
really well was capturing, you know, the contrary nature of Wells.
Yeah.
You know, and then like, and how he was, whatever you said about him was true. And that's, you know, that's one of the confusing, you know, he operated at both, you know, polar opposites of everything all the time.
Right.
And so that I think is really what, you know, what went, and I think Morgan just did an unbelievable job of capturing that. And I think the way he edited it in a way that in some places kind of mirrors the pace of Other Side of the Wind.
Yes. It's very much a companion piece. And that's one of the things I liked about it.
Right. And it takes, and competing with, you know, I mean, not that he was setting out to compete with Orson, you know, but like kind of, you know, doing something that's like, okay, I'm going to do kind of what a little bit of what Orson did when I'm doing a thing about Orson is like, took a lot of creative courage, and he totally pulled it off.
Yeah, I mean, if there's anything, for no other reason that I love this, that this film exists, there are two things. First of all, you include some trivia that I didn't know, that Orson Welles did editing on a porno film, which is, I never knew that, to help out his pal Gary Graver, and so Gary could finish the book, because Gary had to shoot pornos to make ends meet in between shooting Other Side of the Wind, and to help finish up one movie, get it done faster, Orson actually helped edit the sex scene, the shower sex scene in the porno movie called 3 AM. Now I'm dying to see 3 AM now. I can't find it anywhere, but I really want to see it.
I have to tell you, that was possibly like the weirdest moment of my professional life, because I, you know, first of all, I'm like, okay, I'm like, well, let me see if I can find this on, you know, online, and let me see if I can find this scene online. And Joe McBride had written about it. And I mean, this is so insane. I couldn't believe I was having this discussion. But he had, you know, written something about how it was like a, oh God, it was a shower scene. And I think he wrote, you know, that it was like a masturbation scene. And I like kept watching the film over and over. And I'm like, there's no masturbation. There's it's a lesbian scene. And so I'm having this exchange of emails with, you know, this, you know, this Wells scholar. And I'm like, I think it's a lesbian scene, Joe. And he's like, no, it's a masturbation scene. And we're like going back and forth. I'm like, this is like, if anybody say, looked at these emails, they would be like, what is with these?
What are these guys? Two pervs talking about? What is going on? Yeah. I was so
funny. I mean, and Joe is like such a scholar, you know, like in this area. I'm like, we're having this ridiculous email exchange about, you know, masturbation versus lesbian scene. So, yeah.
Oh, I'm dying to see it. I love that this, I learned something new. And then the other thing that your film includes, which I really loved, is that it features that clip with Henry Jaglom talking about, because Orson Welles' final acting appearance is in Henry Jaglom's film, Somebody Sure. to Love. And that film is almost impossible to find now. I watched it on VHS at the aforementioned video store that I talked about earlier. And I love it because Orson sort of plays himself. He's kind of this Greek chorus character who is literally sitting up in a balcony commenting on what's going on. And you see it in the film, Orson Welles, and this is Orson Welles' final film, not Transformers, screw you haters. This is his final film, is in Henry Jaglom's Somebody to Love, and he literally says the word cut And that is the right. final film. That is the final word Orson Welles ever says on film. And it's perfect. And I because that film is so inaccessible and that scene is not available on YouTube anywhere, I'm so thankful you guys put that scene in the movie so people could see it. Because it's so wonderful and it's so sweet. And I'm glad now it's available for everybody to see.
And it's so perfectly, like, you know, Wellesian, right? That, like, that's his final words on screen are cut. You know, it's like his
whole cut again.
Yeah, like, you know, it's like the mirroring of the, you know, the life and the art. You know, it's like, of course, you know, he's like the great director and his final words on screen are cut.
Oh, it's fantastic. You know?
Yeah. He was was an amazing scene. And Henry was a great interview. Talking to him and Paul Mazursky about their scene together was like some of the most fun. I'm sad that Paul didn't live to be in the documentary. Because my interview with him was one of the funniest interviews, I've ever had. He started immediately, like I was explaining to him the situation with the Iranians and how they had financed it. And he started describing the opening scene of a movie based on the book. And, you know, he's like, we're in the desert. You know, he's like, and you can see nothing. He's like, and then all of a sudden you see the glint of a light, you know, off of something, and then another thing, and then another thing, and then you see it's a line of, you know, limousines pulling up to this, you know, palace in the middle of nowhere, and they're screening The Other Side of the Wind, you know, and he's like, you know, it's all the mullahs are, you know, sitting there, and, you know, there's the Ayatollah sitting at the head of the table, you know, they're like, why are there so many shadows? You know, like, isn't that Rich Little? What's he doing in this movie? You know, and listening to him do that, I was like, oh my God. But that and interviewing Rich Little, how I did not record that interview, I could like kill myself over that because that was amazing. You kind of like, you forget how good an impressionist somebody who's a really good impressionist is. And it was just incredible listening to him. You know, he's like perfect Wells, perfect Houston, just, you know, back and forth, you know, seamlessly. So that was really fun.
Yeah, it's a great document. And I would say, even though we discussed it in reverse order, I would say everybody, if you're interested in Other Side of the Wind, watch They'll Love Me When I'm Dead first and then watch Other Side of the Wind, because I think it forms the film. It's mostly just about that period in Welles' life. It does go into the other stuff. Obviously, it's a little rich history, but you couldn't do a single documentary on Orson Welles. You would have to do it like a week-long, you know, 12-part documentary or something. But I think it's a perfect companion piece. It's entertaining in and of its own right, even if you've already seen Other Side or you have no plans to see it. It's just an entertaining view about a filmmaker at a particular point in his life, but it really does work as like a nice companion piece. So it's really great, and it's all available on Netflix. So everybody listening to this, if you haven't seen it, check it out. So, Josh, I think we're going to wrap it up here. And, you know, you said about how fortunate you felt that you got to work with Morgan Neville, that you got to be involved with this filmmaker who you like, and it was involving your project. I mean, I kind of feel that way about talking to you. I feel very fortunate and very honored that someone who wrote a book about this thing that I love, this person I love, and a book I enjoyed so much, will be here to talk to me and be on my show. So I really appreciate it. This has been fantastic. And I was thrilled to have you on the first time. And then now that the movie exists, to be able to talk to you again about it, it's just unbelievable. So thank you so much for coming on and doing this.
It was absolutely my pleasure.
All right, everybody. Well, thanks everybody for listening. Again, this is the first show back of the Film and Water after taking a couple of months off. I'm going to be doing the shows in a kind of different rhythm. I'm going to be doing a bunch of episodes all at the same time, and then I'm going to take another break and do some other shows and then come back. So we're going to be doing things a little differently, but we will be doing some other movies in subsequent weeks of the show. So again, thanks everybody for listening. Thanks for all the support you've shown on the show to this point, and I'm really glad that we can be doing Film and Waters again. So of course, if you want to find back episodes of the show, go to the website, fireandwaterpodcast.com. You can subscribe on iTunes and Stitcher, places like that. And we're always talking movies over on Twitter, which is at Film and Water Pod. So again, thanks everybody for listening. And until the next episode, that's a wrap.
I shot Someone to Love, which is Orson's last movie as an actor, before he died. And he turns to me and he says,
"We come into the world alone, we die alone, we live alone. Love and friendship is the nearest thing that we can find to create the illusion that we are not totally alone.
So I'm working on that after Orson died, and I get a knock on my door, and it's John Huston. He says, you have footage of Orson that I haven't seen. I said, well, I'll put it up for you.
As far as this movie is concerned, it seems to me you got your ending.
Why?
Because we have come to the end.
I'm glad you came today.
So am I.
Thank you. Stay a little longer?
We really can't go on recording this.
Why?
It's got too sweet.
I'm not going to say cut.
I'll say cut. I'm a director.
Say
cut.
Say it into the camera.
What?
Say it into the camera.
I did.
Could you do it again?
You want me to say cut again?
Into the camera.
He wants to improvise and do it twice. Cut.
Huston turned to me and he said, he let you do that. He said, oh, that's wonderful. I've always wanted him on film laughing. That was so, and he started crying. He started crying, Huston, watching Orson laughing.